Sure is. Fascinating discussion as we talk about creation. Wait till you hear what's up next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. We're with Tricia McKinnon and Peter Canova. Peter, let's get back into the Nag Hammadi again. And I was asking you about the tie-in with the Dead Sea Scrolls. You think they're very different, but go ahead.
Well, I think the focus on the Nag Hammadi Gospels really delves far deeper into the spiritual mysteries than what you're going to see in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Nag Hammadi Gospels are just fantastic in terms of the kind of information that these mystic seers were able to delve into and bring back the spiritual, the psychological information, their whole cosmology, and even one of the talks I do around the country that I'll be talking about at the Conscious Living Expo is how you can take so many aspects of these texts and relate them directly to quantum physical events that they're describing now, in our century. So these guys were pretty advanced seers, and in terms of the information they brought back from the other side.
That's also something that Peter and I are going to be talking about, George, at great length the weekend following the expo, because once we connected last year, we realized all these synergies between what he knew and what I knew. So we're actually doing an event called Creation Matrix 2012, which we'd love to invite you to. It's going to be at the LAX Hilton, actually the next weekend of the 18th and 19th, and we're going to be talking about the Tree of Life and the Divine Feminine Energy with the Divine Masculine and these hidden secrets and how they connect to these discoveries in quantum physics, how they connect to the Return of the Gods, how they connect to 2012, because I think it's all related. So this show we're doing is absolutely, spot on for this information, and it's very pertinent because we've just arrived in 2012, the famous, Mayan.
Here we are. That's right.
It's hard to believe we're here, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I thought it was so long ago, and it's not.
Well, it just seems like a couple of years ago we were at Y2K, and a lot of people who went to Y2K were, they felt like maybe when nothing happened, they thought, well, maybe we were idiots to be so concerned. But in truth, there was a technological glitch in the computers, which they didn't come up with a way to solve until April of that year, and it took them the rest of the year to implement it, or we would have had some serious shutdowns of our systems. Just like this past year with the passing of Al-Anon, everyone was pretty concerned, people who were following this, and I'm sure you were. We were very concerned because Al-Anon, although it was an asteroid, appeared to be highly electromagnetically charged, and we were afraid that when it came between our sun and our earth, that it would be like the sun would send out a big, great solar jump that could be like a big EMP knocking out all of our systems. And the only reason that didn't happen, I don't think people who believe that were crazy. The only reason it didn't happen is because when it passed Jupiter, it was so highly charged that Jupiter sent out that big solar flare and broke it in two. So we missed a bullet.
Yeah, we did. We lucked out on that. Now, are you too amazed at how the work that you've studied, Sitchin's work and also what Casey's done and then the Nag Hammadi, how they echo the book of Genesis in the Bible?
Well, it's really interesting about the Casey materials and the Nag Hammadi Gospels anyway, in that there are some echoes in there, but the interesting thing is those Gospels, the Nag Hammadi Gospels and the Casey readings, almost read like a prequel to the book of Genesis in the Bible. They actually cover events in the spiritual realm prior to the incarnation of the souls on earth as Adam and Eve. And the Gospels speak of actually two falls. The original fall was a fall of spirit into soul mind. In other words, it was the spirits exercising their free will in order to think of themselves as individual creators as opposed to expressing God's will. And that first thought or that first exercise of free will essentially created soul, which was the use of the God-given mind power to focus on one's own self. And so that was actually the first fall from spirit to soul, and then the second fall was from soul into the physical body, and that's the fall that was described in the book of Genesis.
It's very interesting. Peter and I have had some deep conversations about this, and let me say, I think there's a lot more to say than even what we've touched on. But, you know, the book of Genesis is just the very tail end of a book called the Enumad Elish, which is the Babylonian story of creation, which comes right out of the Sumerian story.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, in Genesis it says, in the beginning, the Elohim, or God created, man, he created him male and female. Well, of course, that's what we think the Bible says, but the actual original word for God was Elohim, which is a plural, meaning those who came down from the sky, the plural of the gods. And so they created man in their image. So, it moves not only from the physical, which is basically what Zachariah Sitchin was dealing with, was he wasn't really dealing with the spiritual at all, or the multidimensional. He was talking pure old history, science, and astronomy. But when Peter starts talking about this stuff, he's taking the view that the mystics and the Gnostics and the spiritual teachings had, that as above, so below, and as below, so above. So were we made in the God's images? Yeah, but we were also made in the image, and even they were made in the image of the God, of God with the big G.
Sure.
Which is, what are we?
Well, do you think we're talking about extraterrestrial visitations or something more angelic?
I think both exist.
Yes.
Both exist. There are all these dimensional planes, and, physics is, like, this is one of the things Peter and I have talked about. Quantum physics has discovered that everything is vibration, and underlying everything we see is light, and behind that is sound. And they now call the sound phonons, and they call the light photons, and the thing that connects them they call gluons, which I think is adorable.
Gluons.
Isn't that cute? Where from the beginning was, in the beginning was the word, that's the sound current that was the primal movement out that began to create the dimensions. And as they came down through the dimensions, of course, they're, let us say, fragments or aspects of God with the big G. And these would be archaeons. And Peter, you can speak to this if you
want. Yeah, well, in the Gnostic Gospels, they have a very interesting little group there called archons, archons, and that's the Greek word for rulers. And these were some of the strangest beings that you'll ever see.
What did they look like, Peter?
Well, the representation of the chief archon, who was called the Demiurge, it had the head of a lion and the body of a serpent. That was a representation that they gave it. Now, they never specifically spoke about an incarnation of these beings known as the archons. These beings were said to have soul but not spirit. In other words, they were pure soul mind. They represented that extreme action of free will where the soul mind almost rejected its remembrance of God in favor of creating on its own. And the archons were said to reside in the planetary spheres. So, just the similar way that the Babylonian, the Sumerian gods were identified with the different planets, so were the archons. And the ancients pictured the Earth almost like surrounded by these bands of spheres represented by the other planets, and the archons ruling over them almost were like gatekeepers and made it very hard for the soul to escape the Earth plane and get back to its original home in the higher realms. In a lot of ways, these archons almost sound like the Anunnaki. They weren't a very enviable group. They were kind of capricious. They could do some good things, but then again, they could do a lot of things that were very detrimental to humankind, and they often, used human beings for their own purposes, kind of drawing off on their energy, playing on their negative emotions and
sure.
things like that. So, you know, to answer your question, George, were these angelic or was it extraterrestrial? It's really, we can't say for sure, but, you know, the funny thing is they echo each other so much that there's something there somewhere. It could be that the Anunnaki, for instance, were incarnations of these beings or distillations of these types of personalities that were described in the Nag Hammadi text.
Well, this is, if you think about what the Tree of Life is, you know, the Tree of Life is a system that came out of Egypt, and probably Thoth developed it, or perhaps it was developed even before the Master Thoth, that basically are three roads to God. And so you start down at the very bottom, Malkuth, the kingdom, that you can't even get to start traveling up the tree until you go to the moon, which, of course, is the next sphere beyond Earth. And the moon represented your emotions. So if you weren't in touch with your emotions and your feminine side, forget it, which is, of course, goes back to the gray aliens coming back to try to get the DNA from the humans in order to get in touch with their emotions because they had genetically bred themselves into a dead-end corner. And then the next, then you get to the place where all three lines are going up to God. You've got the center path and the two paths going up on either side. So you first have to balance your mind, which was represented by Mercury, the mental body,
mm-hmm.
and then Venus, which represents your sensuality. And, you know, your bubble baths and how you like to eat all the time, and, you know, sex is great. And so you have to balance your sensual nature with your mental nature.
Interesting little sidebar here that Thoth, the Egyptian deity that Trisha's mentioned a couple times,
yeah.
Casey said in his readings that Thoth was one of the many incarnations of the Christ spirit.
Well, this would be back to being one of those four Kumaras, the four great Kumaras, or the four sons of God, which are, you know, this is kind of a very interesting conversation because the ancients believed that the divine feminine was everywhere, that she came in again and again and again and again. That's why as Isis, the I Am principle of the feminine, she was known as She of 10,000 Names and 10,000 Faces. She continued to come into this creation because in essence, the explicate world, the material world, is her. Everything we see, all the beauty, everything, all the materiality we're playing in, our bodies, the cosmos, et cetera, et cetera. And I want Peter to speak to that, too, because he has a very beautiful point of view on that. But the Divine Father actually was outside of creation, although, and that the way he entered creation was basically through these four Kumaras or these four sons. And I talk about this in that book on Jesus and the 30 Lost Years and the Mystery Religions, because in truth, We've been taught that Christianity is on one side and that the, quote, pagan teachings or the mysteries are on another side, which is not true at all, because Jesus, being a master of masters, was an initiate of all of those mystery schools in many different lands, and he synthesized his teachings like Buddha did, like Thoth did, into what he called the Way.
In fact, the very earliest Christians, the very early practitioners of the mystery tradition in the West recognized Jesus as one of the incarnations that Trish is talking about, and he was a continuation and was teaching this ancient spiritual tradition, and they became the first Christians. The ironic part of history is that the way that Christianity evolved, it split into two branches, which was the mystical branch and the outer Orthodox branch, which prevailed eventually, and the Orthodox branch represented the great break of the chain of mystic wisdom. They basically pretended like Christianity was this divine inspiration that had been just been dropped down, and it basically flattened everything else, you know, in the pagan world and so forth, that everything, you know, that pagan couldn't be believed. They tore the temples down. They destroyed a lot of knowledge. And it was really kind of criminal what happened, and they represented the first great break in this chain of wisdom. But just to speak to the other point that Trish was talking about, everything she said is absolutely echoed in the Nag Hammadi Gospels. It was the feminine aspect of God, the feminine face of God, that was directly responsible for the creation of the material world, and that feminine aspect actually morphed into even the planet that we have, according to the certain readings of the text. And the male part was remained outside of the creation for a period of time until essentially it came back in to sort of rescue the way things had gone in early creation. Things were kind of getting out of control, mm-hmm. and the male part was the part that ordered, the female part was the part that created. The creation was getting a little out of hand, and the male part essentially came in to sort of rescue the creation and give it order, and it came in through these different avenues, these different avatars or these incarnations that Tricia's been speaking of.
Which is interesting, because if you think about it, you know, initially, I remember when I heard this, that was it's kind of like...
Did you believe it when you first heard it?
Well, like in the negative interpretation, you know, the patriarchy's taught us some crazy things, like Eve is to blame for everything. My God, she ate the apple, so that's why mankind suffers. I mean, never mind that Adam ate the apple, too. And, of course, probably this is just a metaphorical story. But, you know, but as women, you know, we have been raised in a patriarchal culture. Men have had more power. Men have had more money. Men have had, you know, the ability until the last century basically to vote, and they owned women. I mean, the rights of women were taken away with property. We didn't even get the right to vote in America until 1922.
Yeah.
You should Google that. I mean, when you start looking at it, some countries didn't even get it until 1950s. In the 1800s, men sat around in smoking rooms talking about whether women had souls, like we sit around talking about whether animals have souls.
Well, you know, if you take a look at the evolution of consciousness, and in the very earliest days of humanity, when consciousness first descended into physical form, into the physical bodies, that's when we were still closest to our feminine side. We were still close to the intuitive, creative side, and the world must have seemed almost magical and mystical every day to our early ancestors. But then what happened is soul woke up one day and found out, yeah, I am in a physical body. I'm kind of trapped in here, and guess what? There's saber-toothed tigers out there that want to have me for lunch, and there's bad weather coming there that, you know, might blow me off the cliff here. So all of a sudden, they started to face the harsh realities of a physical existence, and then they had to start adopting more male strategies for survival. So analysis organization,
science,
and all those male characteristics had to enter into the human personality in order for it to survive in the physical world. Now, what happened was the strategy succeeded so well that it went overboard, and now we're practically killing ourselves with this. And I think that what we're seeing now is a resurgence of this whole feminine principle and all the interest in, for instance, Mary Magdalene and the divine feminine. This is all an expression of us trying to come back into balance so that the two become one, and we integrate these different aspects of the personality, which are in all of us. We all have male, we all have female. The real trick is to bring them into some kind of an operating symmetry to create a more functional human being.
Is it conceivable that in the early days, these people could not understand the things they were seeing? So like Ezekiel's wheel, which many believe to be a UFO, they talk about it as some kind of flying chariot or something like
that.
Yeah,
I think you're dead on with all that, because they didn't have the science, they didn't have the technology, and, you know, how are you going to describe something you
don't know?
You don't even know.
Sure.
I mean, I think you're dead on with that. But I think one of the things that I really got when I read Peter's book, which, you know, is, quote, a fictional story about basically the return of Mary Magdalene in the 21st century, but she incarnates as a black nun with miracle healing gifts, and she basically saves the life of the Pope, and
yeah,
then he makes her a cardinal, and halfway through the book she becomes the Pope. And the whole idea is that she's reclaiming the church that went down the wrong path for a long time with, you know, the suppression of knowledge and the killing of people who were healers and intuitives and so forth, and that she's reclaiming it to get it back on the right path. And a lot of the original biblical people that were playing out their roles 2,000 years ago reincarnate in this story. But I think the thing that there's a lot that's profound about his book, even though it's couched in fiction. It's very intriguing, because one of the beautiful things I think he did for me is he changed this, my perception, which I had felt like was very kind of damning to women, like Eve was to blame, Sophia the feminine was to blame, we're in this big mess because, you know, she created the world without any male help, and look what a mess we're in. The way he reframed it, and I'm sure Peter...
And hold on, Tricia, we're going to have to come right back and get you. Well, next hour, guess what? We flip a switch and open up the phone lines. That's what we'll do. We'll take your questions with Tricia McKinnon and Peter Canova. But right now, when we come back, more to chat with them about as we talk about creation, the origin and destiny of humanity. And welcome back, Tricia McCannon with us, Peter Canova. Tricia, we were talking about the interpretations of things and how, you know, the ancients would get confused with some of the things they saw in the break goddess. So go ahead, I'll let you pick up from where we were.
Yeah, just to sort of finish that thought, and I hope that Peter will step in here because he, you know, I think is very insightful in reframing, you know, how I think I had originally understood those teachings, which definitely, you know, is kind of like seemed very damning for women, and I don't think that's fair to either sex. I think both sexes have great things about them, and you know, they need each other basically, and we need that balance, as Peter was saying, within ourselves. It was really what the mysteries were aiming for as part of the hierogamma, so the sacred marriage. But one of the ways that Peter reframed it was to say that really none of the world that we know, the physical world, probably the astral planes, would have even been created if there had not been a feminine energy. That it was her, let's say, courage or curiosity, even though she acted alone, that allows this creation to even happen. And maybe you can speak into this a little bit, Peter.
Well, you know, I think like so many things in life, it's a question of how you look at it. Even in the ancient gospels themselves, the seers could be talking about the same events, but they would attach a more positive or more negative slant to it, depending upon you know, their point of view. So the part that was misunderstood, the Bible and the early patriotic world, is that Eve essentially got a bad rap, because the whole idea of falling from a higher state into a tougher world here was blamed on her for for eating the apple. However, in the original interpretation by the early Christians, the serpent wasn't bad at all. The serpent was actually the gift of knowledge that came to mankind, to humankind, in order to enlighten it again and lead it back to an understanding of its own origin, the spark of the divine in its own soul, so that Eve's eating of the apple and listening to the serpent was actually a positive event. But, you know, here's the thing about it. Sometimes we've been trained in our culture to think of a human being as a fallen entity in, yes, in a lowly state. But the real vision, if you really want to read between the lines of all the ancient texts, is that humanity is not a lowly state. It's an exalted state, because we are the fingers of God touching this form of experience, material experience in this world. And we're here to spiritualize the material and to bring the experience of the material back to the spiritual. So if you study the ancient text, this starts to come through to you. And it was really the misinterpretation that twisted things around that led to the whole idea that humanity is a fallen state, and it was all the fault of the, you know, the feminine aspect that led us to this, because there's a whole other body out there that tells a completely different story, that we're here for a purpose, having this experience, that this experience ultimately is the plan of the Supreme Being, even though some people interpret it as a mistake, but it's ultimately the plan of the Supreme Being in order to have a certain set of experiences in a different dimension.
Peter, tell me about some of these failed experiments that you've looked at that have, you know, like aborted experiments in human engineering. What happened?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. This sort of echoes in really all three of the traditions that were that we're talking, yeah, about tonight. So, for instance, and Trish can speak to this, but in the Anunnaki text, it talks about when Enki was experimenting in implanting the DNA of the Anunnaki into a primate, like an ape-like primate, that before he actually succeeded in producing what would be, you know, modern man or Homo sapiens, they produced these kind of monstrous abortions. Now, this whole thing about aborted experiments of human beings is reflected in both the Casey materials and in the Lost Gospel. Casey says that the early souls projected themselves into animal forms in the earth, and then they began to experiment in manipulating the bodies of these animals. And the early results produced these grotesque hybrids, like creatures that would be part humanoid but have the head of a bird. The things that you would see on an Egyptian temple, the things that you see in the Sumerian and Babylonian depictions of these, you know, these different hybrid creatures, including, let's say, even the Greek, the centaurs and the satyrs. These creatures may very well have had a basis in past history because they're spoken of in all these different cultures as sort of, you know, the early aborted experiments of spirit to manipulate fleshly form to find, you know, eventually find a home for itself.
Yeah, it's interesting because in the Casey readings, if you recall, what he talks about is actually that in the material world, souls came down and souls were used to being able to move in more ethereal realms where they could change their shape or they could move from shape to shape more in the astral planes or, let's say, the causal or the mental planes where the laws of density are not so strong. And they initially were able to do some of that down here, but then as they became more densified, they got stuck in matter. And then, you know, how could they get out? And then there was another wave of souls that came down to help them to remember who they were, and they also got stuck in matter. And, of course, we all know how easy it is. You know, you come down here, and we have, you know, 80 years to basically grow up, get enculturated, figure out how to make money. We're looking for love, which many times involves, you know, love, sex, children, very complicated family and social dynamics. And, you know, wake up in the process and become spiritually enlightened and not be owned by any of what they're called the five passions of the mind, lust, anger, greed, vanity, or undue attachment. It's a tall order. I mean, mastery.
You know, it's really interesting the point that Trish brings up on the Casey materials because this also touches on Atlantis, George.
Sure.
And I think you're familiar enough with the Casey materials that it's very interesting about Atlantis, that early Atlantis was not even a physical society. The early Atlanteans, according to Casey, were thought forms. And they essentially were thought forms that were hovering about the earth plane. Over a period of time, they kind of congealed or materialized into physical bodies. But Trish is right. The first wave of them that came in was a disaster. They essentially got so lost and started playing and manipulating in such irresponsible ways that they created these terrible forms. And then the second wave came in that was led by Amelius, or the Christ spirit, essentially, in order to rescue them. Now, the first wave were called the daughters of men. The second wave were called the sons of God. This echoes in the Bible, that kind of mysterious story about how the sons of God came in and they found the daughters of men fair. You know, there were all kinds of mixtures in those days, some ranging from the bestial to, you know, human-appearing forms, but without the, you know, the devoid of the kind of consciousness that later was evolved by the spirit. But it's a very fascinating tale going all the way back to Atlantis about different waves of spirits that came in, ultimately manipulating and affecting the animal forms on the planet until it perfected it to the extent that it was able to have endocrine glands and the chakra system that would allow for the inflowing of the divine energy to better handle the divine consciousness. And that was the version of humanity that eventually became what we are, Homo sapiens sapiens, that appeared about 200,000 years ago, at least according to the fossil record.
Now, this is interesting because, of course, this echoes what the Anunnaki text or the Sumerian text say, which is basically that there were, you know, plenty of life forms down here.
Sure.
And if you look at the fossil record, we basically go from like Australopithecus to Neopithecus to Java man to Neanderthal to Cro-Magnon, and 200,000 years ago, Homo sapiens sapien emerges. And that was, according to, again, Sitchin material, which is based on the Sumerian, when the Anunnaki, who, you know, are taller because they come from a bigger planet, longer lived because their life cycle is linked to the orbit of their planet around the sun. In this case, 3,600 years is 1 year for them. So just imagine they lived 100 of their years. That's going to make them 360,000 years old. And then, of course, they discovered the elixir from the Tree of Life, which is a real nectar that doubled their lifespan. So that's going to put them about 750,000 years if they stay on their planet. When they came to this planet, it affected them biologically. And, you know, so they were only living 400,000 or 350,000 or 500,000 would be a lot because they wound up on a planet with a shorter span. So, but, you know, the point that Peter's making is very interesting because this gets into a whole conversation really about the cycles of time and vibration.
And tell me the tie-in here with that.
Well, if Atlantis, and when I look back on the time track, and like I said, I've read for 6,000 people, and for the first few years, I was only going 3,000 or 5,000 years back. And then I made a leap, and what happened was somebody said to me, can you see if I was a mermaid? And I thought, mermaid, yeah, sure, right, but I didn't say that. And I looked back, and sure enough, I found myself in a much earlier age. And to my surprise, the soul had a split tail. It wasn't a single tail like I always thought of a mermaid. Well, later, of course, I found Greek drawings of particular mer race that did have split tails. And I thought, oh my gosh. Well, when I was back in Atlantis, everything was vibrating at a higher frequency. And then when I eventually made it back to Lemuria, it was at an even higher frequency. And what I mean by this is that I believe that just like everything in the lower worlds moves in a spiral, the atoms move that way, the solar systems move that way, the galaxies move that way, the hair on the top of your head moves that way, the toilet.
Everything
moves that
way. Yeah.
Yes. Time also moves in a spiral. So I believe our planet moved from the fifth dimension very, very slowly down through the ages into the fourth dimension, and then now we're in the third dimension, and I think we sort of hit the toilet, you know, the bottom point about the time Jesus came in, you know, to bring some light back into the planet, and the dark ages, the 1,500 years that came after, and now I think we're beginning to really spiral back up into the fourth dimension, which brings us to the whole Mayan calendar in 2012. And, you know, eventually, who knows, we'll go into the fifth dimension. Maybe that's how it goes. You know, what goes down eventually comes back up.
Yeah, I think there's no question about that. And another interesting little sidebar here, it's been recently discovered that our ancestors of Homo sapiens actually did interbreed with less evolved species, such as Neanderthal and Denisova hominem. So they've actually taken DNA from the fossils of those hominid species, and they detected it in you know, minor traces of it in human beings.
Do you think it was genetic? Because why would a species that would supposedly be, you know, that much more intelligent than a lower species, why would they want to breed with it?
I can give you some answers.
You know, I'm not 100% sure of the answer to that question, George, but the point that I was going to make in this, it's another interesting echo, isn't it, about the sons of God taking the daughters of men to themselves?
Yep.
Well, I'd like to actually address that, and who I really kind of want to cite who's done some research on this is the lovely Dolores Cannon. You know, Dolores, I'm sure you've had her on your show.
Oh, sure. I've known her for years.
I mean, she looks like Betty Crockett, you know, or Crocker, you know, like a grandmother, but she's just smart as a whip. And she
started off with her conversations with Nostradamus.
Exactly. Yeah. And she's gone on through hypnotherapy, which is a very powerful way of putting someone into such a deep space that they go back into their own soul records and chronicled a lot of things. And some of her books chronicle basically ships of groups that have come to Earth from other planets, not just the Anunnaki, the Pleiadian system, the Orion system, the Sirian system, and many others that we don't even know what the names are. And they crash land here. They can't get off. And they realize the sun's too bright for them. And they realize the only hope for their survival is to, in fact, breed with the people that are down here whose bodies are more genetically adapted to the planet. And so that would be one reason for doing it, really, literally for survival.
There have been good gods, but have there been bad gods?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, yes. I mean, I think that just like human beings, there are some of them that had some pretty big egos. And that was one of the very, very big differences between Enlil's group, which was in Mesopotamia, and Inkey's group, which was throughout Africa. And, of course, Ninhursag, their half-sister, had the Sinai Peninsula, which is where the second, after the flood, where the second space station for the shipment of the goals were. And that was supposed to be the neutral territory because she was such a great peacemaker. So when you look at a lot of the gods, let us say, of the Middle East, they're really busy ordering the humans around, much as Michael Tellinger would argue, hey, the slave species of God, you know, we want you to grow our food and pick our fruit and do the manual labor so that we can basically focus on getting the gold in order to save our planet. So they looked at humans as, you know, a means to an end, and, you know, we should just do what they said. The classic story of Gilgamesh, who was half human and half Anunnaki, who, you know, went on the quest to try to get the nectar of the gods from the Tree of Life and attain immortality or extend his life, and it was not to be allowed, where Ishtar saw him, and he was this wonderful hunky guy, and decided, hey, you know, I'm used to picking out the hunkiest guy and making him king and then having him run my cities and sometimes gather an army and fight another one of the gods with their armies. And, of course, Gilgamesh turned her down, and she, you know, she was quite upset about that.
They were fighters, though.
Let me speak to this for 1 second, George, because this is a very interesting point. First of all, I think one thing we have to notice is all these gods that you know, Tricia described, including the Anunnaki, almost kind of don't really deserve the term god. They clearly are some kind of beings with certain superior aspects to them, but
they're not of the
nature of what we were taught to believe is a god, you know, coming from the god of love. They seem to be beings that are still in their own fallen state. But it's really interesting because most spiritual and religious texts always describe a force of opposition that was present at the very foundation of our creation. So, for instance, in early Judaism, the devil wasn't a guy with a pitchfork and cloven hooves that's presiding over hell. The devil was actually an angel of opposition, specifically sent by God to challenge humanity and to give us obstacles that we would have to rise above these limitations so that we could work our way back to a state of knowledge and enlightenment. Now, we talked about the archons before, and the archons are these sort of astral beings in the Nag Hammadi Gospels, and they're sort of pure soul mind. They're really ignorant of higher spirit. They create egotistically, and they create a lot of, they lead us into a lot of dead ends for their own gratification. And, you know, basically in the extreme, they're rather ignorant. They're powerful. They're powerful thought forms, but they're ignorant of the spiritual content. So they act for purposes of self-gratification. So they're selfish in the misuse of their free will. But the strange thing about it is the archons may really have been us. The seers may have actually been talking about is our own collective soul mind that is so powerful, like the collective unconscious, that's so powerful that it actually exerts this force over us that sort of keeps us thinking, you know, we're the be-all and end-all, not God. We're sort of the focus of attention, and we're going to do things for our own creative enjoyment and gratification and so forth, and it leads us away from our own, you know, spiritual source. So my reading in a lot of ways of the archons is they're a little bit allegorically actually speaking of all of us collectively as the human beings misusing our free will.
Well, it's really like, you know, they called it the great adversary. And the adversary, as Peter's saying, is really meant to test us. And so in a way, it's kind of like how is it's the resistance force.
Yes.
And we all deal with the great adversary within ourselves. It's not outside of us. It can play itself out outside of us as a negative government, as, you know, lying and cheating corrupt officials, as chemical poisonings in our food and our atmosphere. Yeah, but all that's done by human beings, isn't it? And those are human beings that are basically putting greed, power, and short-term gain over the health of the planet, the people, and the generations to come. So they're people who have fallen into those same selfish, you know, negative demigod fashions, even though they're in human form.
Okay, well, when we come back with both of you next hour, final hour, we'll take phone calls. They've been lining up. We'll take calls next on Coast to Coast AM.